In New York, this is Democracy Now!
What are we doing wrong?
We come right
We're
back.
We're exercising
you
our
come right back.
Right.
You come right
what
back.
What they're doing is illegal. Those fences are illegal.
Thousands of Amazon workers have launched the largest strike against Amazon in U.S. history. We'll speak with an Amazon worker from Georgia and the president of a New York local. Then, as Luigi Mangione is extradited to New York and charged in the killing of the CEO of United Healthcare, we'll look at the growing anger directed at the health insurance industry. Kevin Dwyer was denied life-saving medicine for cystic fibrosis by United Healthcare for 9 months.
When I went through my denial with United Healthcare, I was extremely angry, and I know that there's plenty of other people out there when I was going through mine that I talked to who are going through similar things. The one thing that I hope is that the United Healthcare, all insurance companies, and the politicians will wake up and see the anger and that healthcare needs to be reformed.
We'll also speak with leading healthcare advocate Elizabeth Benjamin about what you do when your claim is denied. Then don't obey in advance.
Right now, we actually have much more power than we think we do. Our actions are magnified outwards now. When protest becomes illegal or dangerous, this is going to change. But right now, Americans actually have more power than they think they do.
Yale historian Timothy Snyder on tyranny, on everything from Trump's billionaire cabinet to ABC News' multi-million dollar settlement with President-elect Trump. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's relentless attacks across the Gaza Strip killed at least 77 Palestinians over the past 24 hours. An Israeli strike on two schools turned shelters killed at least 15 displaced Palestinians in Gaza City. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have continued their siege on North Gaza with attacks reported in Beit Hanun. Israeli quadcopters were also seen shooting civilians in Jabalia al-Balad. Meanwhile, the UN General Assembly Thursday overwhelmingly approved a resolution asking the International Court of Justice to assess Israel's obligations to facilitate the delivery of UN and international aid to Palestinians in Gaza. Israel's repeatedly blocked the entry of life-saving aid into the besieged territory. In more related news, Doctors Without Borders said in a new report published Thursday that Israel's war on Gaza depicts clear signs of ethnic cleansing. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers Friday set fire to a mosque in the village of Marda, spray-painting revenge and death to Arabs and Hebrew on the Muslim holy site. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemned the attack, calling on the UN to launch an investigation. This is Nasfat Al-Khufash, head of the Marda Village Council.
Today on Friday, Marda woke up to a systemic terror attack by a group of settlers who set fire to Bir al-Waladin Mosque. A number of settlers set fire and attempted an attack on a wider scale in the mosque. As you see the aftermath of this, along with writing racial slurs such as death to Arabs and that they will burn this mosque to build a synagogue. These attacks are continuous and systematic by settler groups.
The attack on the mosque came as at least six Palestinians were killed across the West Bank, including an 80-year-old woman who was shot in the chest by Israeli forces during a raid in the Balata refugee camp near Nablus Thursday. In Tulkarm, at least four Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a vehicle. Senior U.S. officials have arrived in Damascus on the first U.S. diplomatic mission to Syria in over a decade. The officials are expected to meet with members of HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Asham, the armed Islamist group that helped overthrow Bashar al-Assad's regime earlier this month. The meeting's occurring even though HTS remains on the State Department's terrorist list. This comes as questions remain over the fate of Kurdish populations in Syria. A commander of the U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish forces said it would agree to withdraw any non-Syrian Kurdish fighters from northern Syria if Turkey agrees to a complete ceasefire.
We said that we are ready to withdraw our forces from the border and for the area to be free of our forces and for the international security forces to be present instead of our forces. In addition to the presence of American forces in the area to supervise this area, on the condition that there is a complete truce.
The Wall Street Journal reports an official in the Syrian Kurd civilian administration's directly appealed to Donald Trump to pressure Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan against sending troops into Syria. Meanwhile, press freedom groups have condemned the killing of two Kurdish women journalists, Cihan Belki and Nazim Dashtam, by a Turkish drone as they were reporting on attacks on the Tishrin Dam on the outskirts of Kobani. Meanwhile, Syria's interim education minister reassured the nation that a new government will not restrict girls' access to education. On Thursday, Syrian youth and women gathered in Damascus to call for their rights to be respected in any new government.
We are here to participate as youths in order to be together hand in hand, to be a secular, democratic state where there is equality and maintenance of women's rights. So far, we do not know what the situation will be, and we are not attacking or judging anyone because it is still so early. But it is our right to hold on to our rights. It is our right to know where we are going to and participate together as Syrians to build a Syria for all.
Thousands of Amazon warehouse workers and delivery drivers at seven facilities across four states, New York, Georgia, California, and Illinois, are entering a second day of an historic strike. After taking to the picket lines Thursday, it comes after Amazon refused to bargain fair contract as workers demand higher wages, better benefits, and safer working conditions. The Teamsters described it as the largest strike against Amazon in U.S. history. President Sean O'Brien said in a statement, quote, "If your package is delayed during the holidays, you can blame Amazon's insatiable greed," unquote. Here in New York, police stormed the picket line at an Amazon facility in Queens, arresting an Amazon driver on strike and a Teamsters leader. They were both later released. On Wednesday, reports emerged of Amazon founder and Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos dining with President-elect Trump and tech billionaire Elon Musk at Mar-a-Lago. We'll have more on this story after headlines. As the Amazon action picks up steam, unionized Starbucks workers have launched 5 days of phased strikes as the coffee giant has repeatedly refused to bargain in good faith. Starbucks baristas in Los Angeles, Chicago, and Seattle are striking today. The action will escalate through Christmas Eve. Over 500 Starbucks stores nearly unanimously voted to approve the strike. The U.S. government appears to be hurtling towards a shutdown after the House voted down a new Trump-approved bill Thursday evening that included a 2-year suspension of federal debt limit. This comes after Trump and Elon Musk intervened to sink the previous bipartisan package. House Speaker Mike Johnson has until the end of the day to introduce and pass another spending measure before a partial shutdown is triggered tonight. An appeals court Thursday disqualified Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis from overseeing Georgia's election interference case against Donald Trump and his 18 co-defendants. Her removal follows revelations of a prior relationship with the lead prosecutor. The fate of the sweeping criminal racketeering case against Trump is unclear, but it's likely to be paused as Trump returns to office or dismissed altogether. Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, was arraigned in a New York court Thursday after being extradited from Pennsylvania and charged with murder, 2 stalking charges and a firearms offense. The federal murder charge carries a possible death penalty. Mangione had already been facing state murder and terrorism charges. A handcuffed Mangione was led into custody by a massive escort in New York, including heavily armed police and Mayor Eric Adams. The case has galvanized public outrage over the U.S. health insurance industry. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. A former top advisor to embattled New York Mayor Eric Adams was indicted on bribery and conspiracy charges Thursday. Ingrid Lewis Martin resigned Sunday ahead of the expected indictment. Her son and 2 real estate agents were also charged in the case, which accused them of making over $100,000 in exchange for expediting approvals on construction projects. It's just the latest indictment of a close associate of Mayor Adams, who himself was indicted in a federal corruption case. President Biden laid out a new target to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by up to 66% in 2035 compared to 2005 levels. The Biden administration says that even with Trump's return to office, that target can still be met if states and local governments commit to their emission reduction goals. Independent studies have shown the U.S. is not currently on track to meet such targets. Meanwhile, a group of employees from the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy published an open letter to the White House Thursday condemning the withholding of federal climate funds from the group Climate Justice Alliance after it spoke out against genocide in Gaza. The group called on the U.S. agencies to end their collaboration with Israel, writing, quote, "We decry the prioritization of funding for bombs and tanks over the resourcing of communities impacted by accelerating climate disasters." In Sudan, the World Food Program is reporting at least three of its staff were killed in an aerial bombardment. It's unclear if the attack was carried out by the Sudanese army or paramilitary rapid support forces, which have intensified their fighting as the war in Sudan enters its 20th month. The agency warns Sudan risks becoming the world's largest hunger crisis in recent history, with 1.7 million people either facing famine or at risk of famine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken Thursday announced $200 million in humanitarian aid to Sudan. Meanwhile, Reuters reports the Biden administration has vowed to provide U.S. lawmakers an assessment on whether the United Arab Emirates is providing weapons to the rapid support forces by January 17th. Both warring parties in Sudan have been accused of human rights violations. French President Emmanuel Macron was met with protests and booing crowds Thursday as he toured the devastating aftermath of Cyclone Chido in the Indian Ocean islands of Mayotte, which is a French territory. Anger's mounting over the insufficient aid delivered since the disaster. Only 31 deaths have been confirmed, but many fear the true toll could be in the thousands. Survivors say they've been left with nothing.
Nothing. All the food we had, the rice, the meat, the sugar, it's all gone. All the fruits, the mangoes that were left, all gone. We have nothing to eat. I want to ask that when the help arrives, that it's shared with everybody, not only for people with identity documents, undocumented people as well, because we're all facing the same struggle.
In Nigeria, at least 35 children were killed in a crowd crush at a school fair in the southwestern city of Ibadan. Police have arrested eight people, including the main sponsor of the event, which had said it expected some 5,000 children to take part after advertising gifts and prizes, including scholarships. And Ecuador has converted part of its $1.5 billion external debt into a fund aimed at the protection of forests and wetlands in the Amazon rainforest. The Ecuadorian government renegotiated its debt, resulting in some $460 million in savings that'll be allocated toward the efforts. Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa praised the completion of the country's second debt for nature swap.
The demand for this program has been incredible. It has been more than four times what we were actually able to place. This is a good sign. It is a sign for the future that there can be mechanisms like this on a slightly larger scale and can generate a more significant impact.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of Amazon workers organizing with the Teamsters Union have launched the largest strike against Amazon in U.S. history. In the midst of peak holiday shopping season, drivers and workers at seven facilities in New York, Georgia, Illinois, and California went on strike Thursday to pressure Amazon to come to the negotiating table as workers demand better benefits, higher wages, and safer working conditions. The strike comes days after the Senate Labor Committee, led by Senator Bernie Sanders, published a report that found Amazon systematically ignores and rejects recommended worker safety measures and deliberately misrepresents workplace injury data. This is a video from the Teamsters with workers explaining why they're joining the strike.
I believe a strike is definitely going to make Amazon realize that we're not playing, we're serious.
BBK4 has started a revolution, and I believe that Amazon will turn under the pressure and cave in and pay us.
Amazon is not respecting us. We've been trying to get Amazon to recognize us as Teamsters, and they're not coming to the table.
And that's why now we are ready to strike them, to actually show them what exactly we are fighting for.
On Wednesday night, just before the strike began, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos dined with President-elect Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk at Mar-a-Lago. Bezos also committed to donate $1 million to Trump's inauguration fund through Amazon. As workers continue to join picket lines at hundreds of Amazon fulfillment centers across the country, Amazon spokesperson Kelly Nantel claimed in a statement most of the workers on strike are, quote, almost entirely outsiders, not Amazon employees or partners, and the suggestion otherwise is just another lie from the Teamsters, unquote. The $2 trillion company employs more than 1.5 million people. The Teamsters represent about 10,000 workers. Teamsters President Sean O'Brien said in a statement, quote, if your package is delayed during the holidays, you can blame Amazon's insatiable greed. We gave Amazon a clear deadline to come to the table and do right by our members. They ignored it, unquote. For more, we're joined by two guests. Ron Sewell is with us, an Amazon associate at Amazon facility in East Point, Georgia. He's joining us from Fort Worth, Texas. And here in New York, we're joined by Connor Spence, the president of the only Amazon local, ALU-IBT Local 1, at the Staten Island Amazon Warehouse, the first Amazon facility to unionize. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Connor, let's begin with you. Explain this strike and respond to Amazon saying these are all outsiders who are striking.
Yeah, so for more than 2 years at our facility, JFK in Staten Island, Amazon has been refusing to come to the table, negotiate a strong union contract with the workers. This is obviously in violation of federal law. Now across the country, they have this same obligation with bargaining units, over 20 of them across 10 states. We are all joined together as part of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, National Amazon Division, and we're engaging in a coordinated action to try to put the pressure on Amazon, stop breaking the law, come to the table. This is an unfair labor practice strike over their refusal to bargain.
And can you talk more about the significance of this largest strike against Amazon in history?
Well, in the U.S., there hasn't been large coordinated action like this. And actually, I do want to comment on the point Amazon is trying to make that this is somehow just an outsider action. You can go to any one of these picket lines where the workers have walked off the job and see that's not the case. Last time I was on the show, I talked about how Amazon has 150% turnover in their warehouses nationwide. Something like this, organized on this scale, has to be internal, has to be worker to worker. It has to come from the inside. The idea that this could be done by outsiders is just ridiculous on Amazon's part. It's really a narrative I think they want to push so that other workers who are not yet organizing don't see this and become inspired that they can also fight to change their conditions.
At the Amazon picket line in Queens here in New York Thursday, police arrested then released Teamsters organizer Anthony Rosario, as well as Jagernsen Cardenas, one of the striking Amazon workers. NYPD agents also threatened the crowd with mass arrest. Journalist Luis Feliz León of Labor Notes captured the moment of Cardenas's arrest. New York police officers swarmed Cardenas and blocked him in the cab of his van. So if you can describe the scene and the scene around the country, Connor.
I would say there's a lot of energy, a lot of activity. I mean, I don't think it's like I think it's very significant to point out to people that it's the dead of winter, we're nearing the holidays. People would rather walk off the job than spend another day in the warehouse under those conditions. And I think you can really, when you go to these picket lines, you can feel that energy. The workers they're tired, they feel exploited, they feel abused. And the only thing stopping more workers from taking action is just the time it takes to organize in these conditions. And it's gonna keep building, and you can sense that when you're on the line.
I wanted to also bring in Ron Sewell, Amazon associate working in East Point, Georgia, also an Amazon Learning Ambassador, helps train new hires and other associates punished by Amazon for organizing on safety issues. He filed an unfair labor practice against Amazon, and Amazon settled. He's usually in Georgia, but now in Fort Worth, Texas. Talk about the issues that you face and other workers face.
Thank you for having me. Yes, the issues that we face there is the common safety issues such as clean water, cool air in the South, overheating building, people passing out, and no, when I say no response from management to even speak with us or talk with us. And therefore, that's why we are in strong support of the New York picketers. And we're doing the same thing here in the location, East Point.
Can you talk about the dangers that workers face, the level of injury on the job? Talk about what Senator Sanders talked about in the Senate.
Well, the dangers in the job, what Senator Sanders talked about, is real. We have employees just recently, last week, I had had to assist an employee who passed out that was working the early morning, and he was trying to get to a place where he can sit down either in the break room or in the restroom, but before he even reached that area, he passed out on the floor in front of me, hitting his head, hitting his face. So the danger is real. It's not something that we're making up. We have an older population as well as a younger population, and that's something health-wise, safe-wise, that we submitted a request to OSHA, and we got a visit by them, and they went through the whole facility.
Has ATL-6 in Atlanta and East Point unionized?
No, we have not unionized, but we do have the full support of the Teamsters and what have you, and we are fighting for our individual rights, and we will continue doing that and continue supporting the Teamsters and all others in getting Amazon to come at least management, talk with us, listen to our demands, listen to our concerns.
If you can explain who's unionized and who hasn't, Connor, and explain your position. You're the only president of a local Amazon Teamsters unit.
So in 2022, we were the first warehouse to win an actual NLRB election. Since then, many other warehouses across the country have gone through the NLRB process, not quite the same way we did. Instead, they signed a majority of their coworkers on union cards, demonstrated that majority of the company. The company, under a newer NLRB ruling, had about 2 weeks to contest that majority, file elections with the NLRB. They refused to do so. So in doing so, it was a tacit recognition that those majorities exist. And therefore, that has happened in over 20 bargaining units across the country. And that number continues to grow as the movement expands and we organize more workers.
The Teamsters president, O'Brien, spoke controversially at the Republican convention. Do you think unions will do better under Trump?
I mean, I think it remains to be seen. I'm very much a fan of the current NLRB General Counsel, Jennifer Bruzzo. But I think that ultimately what we've learned, even in the past 4 years under Biden, is that the NLRB is not the main instrument of change here. It's building worker power, and we have to do that under any administration, under any NLRB.
And are you calling for people not to use Amazon, to boycott Amazon?
I think a better thing for me to say is if you choose to shop on Amazon this holiday, A good thing to do would be to meet with your driver, have a conversation with them when they drop off your package, ask them about their working conditions. If there are things they would want to change, tell them that you've seen Amazon workers organizing on TV, that they should consider joining the Teamsters, and they have the full support of you and the community if they choose to do that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Connor Spence is president of Amazon Labor Union, IBT Local 1. And I want to thank Ron Sewell for joining us, ex-Amazon associate working in the ATL 6 facility in East Point, Georgia, talking to us from Texas. Coming up, as Luigi Mangione is brought to New York and charged in the killing of the CEO of UnitedHealthcare, Brian Thompson, we'll look at the growing anger directed at the health insurance industry. Stay with us. Kolesnikov, opening song to the film Underground, and a favorite of Steven Englander. The visionary director of ABC No Rio, who died last Friday at the age of 63 from a rare lung disease he battled for years while securing a new site for the legendary New York City DIY art and community space. He lived long enough to see the groundbreaking in July. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, appeared in a federal court here in New York Thursday after being extradited from Pennsylvania, where he was arrested. Prior to the court appearance, Mangione was seen in Lower Manhattan being escorted from a helicopter by the FBI, by the New York Police Department, and New York Mayor Eric Adams. He's been charged with first-degree murder, second-degree murder as an act of terrorism for fatally shooting Thompson on the morning of December 4th, as the CEO was walking to UnitedHealth's annual investor conference. A newly filed federal complaint has revealed new details about a notebook Mangione had at the time of his arrest. According to authorities, it, quote, contains several handwritten pages that express hostility toward the health insurance industry and wealthy executives in particular. In a separate manifesto, Luigi Mangione wrote, quote, frankly, these parasites simply had it coming. A reminder, the U.S. has the number one most expensive healthcare system in the world, yet we rank roughly 42 in life expectancy, he wrote. According to investigators, Mangione had written the words deny, defend, and depose on the bullet casings used in the assassination. The killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO has brought renewed attention to the practices of the health insurance industry, and especially UnitedHealth Group, which made $22 billion in profits last year. We're joined now by two guests here in New York. Elizabeth Benjamin is with us. She is vice president of health initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York. She's co-founder of Healthcare for All New York campaign. And Kevin Dwyer is with us. He's a cystic fibrosis patient who's written about his battle with UnitedHealthcare after he was denied life-saving medicine. You have you're a family of seven kids.
Yes, correct.
Four of you have cystic fibrosis,
correct.
Kevin.
Yes.
So talk about what happened to you.
Well, in 2012, there was a new medication that came onto the market called Kalydeco. It was a game-changing medication for cystic fibrosis patients. It, instead of just treating the symptoms of the disease, which is previously that's all we had. It actually started to work at the root cause of cystic fibrosis and the defective gene. It was only for one specific mutation out of thousands of mutations for cystic fibrosis. I started to do research about the medication, about the specific gene, talked to my doctor. My sister then went and tried to get the medication.
And she get it?
And she got it, yes. I then went ahead with all the same information, because we have the same gene, and I was denied by UnitedHealthcare.
She also had UnitedHealthcare.
She had UnitedHealthcare,
yes. UnitedHealthcare approved her prescription.
Correct. They denied her at first, and then she had to go through the appeal process. Mm-hmm. And at the appeal process, she got approved for the medication.
Well, you're looking very good now. I don't know what that means.
Yes.
But so explain what happened, because you were not doing well after you were denied.
No, I was not. I was at a point in my health where it was starting to decline, and it was declining rapidly. At the time, I was probably about 30% lung capacity.
You were put on a lung list to get a new lung?
Yes, I was just about to be. We started having conversations about getting lung transplant, double lung transplant. So the thought of getting this medication that could stop my decline was everything to me. And it was devastating when I got the denial, because my sister had just received the medication, and I had used all the exact same information that she had used.
To the same health insurance company.
To the same health insurance company, yes, United.
And she was doing well?
She was doing great. Her lung functions went up. She was clearing out the mucus in her lungs much easier as I was going the opposite direction.
About to get on the lung transplant list. So what did it take for this to turn around for you?
In the end...
These days in America, you have to go to the doctor and a lawyer when you're sick?
Absolutely, yes. It took a lot. I went to representatives. I went to doctors. I went to lawyers. I ended up finally going to health advocacy groups. The lawyer was helping, but in the end, the only thing that really got me the medication was it became a national story, and it was on the Today Show, and UnitedHealthcare just happened to change their tune and then gave me the medication.
But can you explain what happened? The Today Show called UnitedHealthcare and said, we're about to run this story?
Correct.
They
yes.
had denied you right up until then?
Absolutely, yeah.
And when the Today Show called, they then called you and said, it's going to be approved? If you don't go on the Today Show?
Absolutely, yes. There was a caveat there. The question that was posed to me was, do you want this medication or do you want your interview to run on the Today Show? So I said, well, of course I want the medication, but it can't be contingent on an interview, because they have my interview. They're going to do what they want to do. And so then there was negotiations, and then they finally came back and said, okay, you can have it, and you can go on the Today Show. And,
So this is what it takes, Elizabeth Benjamin. One of your steps was to go to Community Service Society. That's where you met Elizabeth Benjamin.
Right. Yes. And honestly, when I went to her after she got involved, the conversation started to change a little bit, but it still wasn't, they still weren't going to approve the medication, but at least she was able to get to some people that were able to maybe change the way they were looking at my case.
And Elizabeth, you too are a lawyer. You have several advanced degrees in public health, and you have a law degree. This is what it takes in America today to not get on the lung transplant list?
It shouldn't take this, but unfortunately, it does. What we know from the research is, well, first of all, we don't know very much at all, because there's been a total abrogation by all government to actually require health insurance companies to report how many denials they issue. Some states do, some states don't. What at the federal level, they're required to capture this data, but again, some states refuse to participate or have not participated, including, unfortunately, our own New York State, because it's sort of required in the Affordable Care Act to report the number of denials and the reason for the denials, but that's a law that's not basically being honored in the breach. So what we do know from the states that do participate in this one sort of subset of, get it, 350 million claims, so that's a pretty big subset, is that about 17% of all claims are denied. What we also know is the rates of denial are wildly random. In one state, it's 2%. In another state, it's 49%. So wow. It's completely random where you live and what's going on in terms of the regulation of insurance carriers. And the other last sad thing from that same data set that we know is that less than 0.1% of, so 0.1 of 1% of people appeal. So the first thing I would always say to a patient is appeal, 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 because eventually you will prevail, although poor Kevin had the hardest appeal I've ever seen.
But eventually you won't necessarily win, right?
You won't necessarily.
But explain what it means to appeal. What do you do first?
So first of all, the first thing you should do if you get a claims denial is call your carrier and make sure that your provider submitted the right code.
And when you say provider, you mean your doctor?
Yes, your doctor. But it could be your hospital. It could be a doctor. It could be, you know, the pharmacist. I mean, so that's why we say provider. It's sort of a euphemism for all these characters in your healthcare ecosystem. So the first thing you should do is call the insurance company and understand why they're denying the claim. And then, you know, circle back with your provider to make sure the right codes, if they say it's a coding issue or they didn't do a prior approval step or something like that, figure out what the problem is. If you're getting denied based on a thing called medical necessity, then you have a real chance in the appeal process to win. People on their own in New York State, thanks to Kevin and a bunch of us, we now know if people go to the state's external review process, on their own, they win about 45% of the time. So already you
have... What is the state's external review process?
Sure.
Who do you call?
So after you exhaust, go through all the appeals at your insurance carrier, if you have a medical necessity denial or an experimental investigation treatment denial, so if you have a denial that's not based on whether it's actually something that's covered by your insurance. So some people might ask your insurance company to pay for vitamins and vitamins aren't covered, for example, in that plan. So then you have no real basis for your appeal. You just have to do whatever the carrier does. But most people who are denied really are denied based on medical necessity. Then you have the right to go through the state's, first the internal plan appeal process, which has very strict time limits. So make sure you understand those time limits. And then if you lose there, in almost every plan in America now, you have the right to go to an external appeal agent. And that agent in our state, it's, you know, a contractor or three contractors for the state of New York. Those people have independent doctors that look at the healthcare plan's decision. If you do that, you have a 50-50 chance of winning. If you come to us, you have an 87% chance of winning. So having an expert really pushes you along the sort of external appeal win
chance. And what is peer-to-peer? This not only affects patients like Kevin. You have doctors spending much of their time who wanted just to help patients negotiating prior approval, negotiating denials. The doctor then has to talk to an external doctor and say, this is why we think that he shouldn't need a new lung.
It's rarely a conversation. What the doctors have to do is even worse. They have to write, like, little dossiers in support. So there's no conversation. So it would that it was that easy. Sometimes the doctors get to talk to a nurse at United, but rarely it's to another doctor. Often it's nurses. Sometimes it's AI. We understand now more and more.
Artificial intelligence?
Is making some of these initial denials is what we're being told. Although, you know, some states are trying to make that illegal. It's very bad because the way we regulate insurance is we don't. We basically let willy-nilly state do regulation. They do their best, but if we had a real understanding and real transparency about these denials and the nature of these denials, I think we would all know a lot more and maybe improve the system for everybody.
Do people answer the phone if you call up with a denial?
Eventually. I mean, wait times are not unheard of with any customer servicing.
And this is when you're getting sicker and sicker. Yes. So you're fighting the insurance company and fighting cancer.
Yeah. And there's a thing called financial, in that case, there's a thing, a proven phenomena called financial toxicity. And so as you're dealing with medical debt or as you're dealing with an insurance claim, it actually exacerbates your physical condition. This has now been documented. And so for cancer survivors, there's a very important study in the Journal of American Medical Association. They're saying cancer survivors, as a result of the compounding financial toxicity, lose about 1 year of life. And, you know, many more days in morbidity. So it's quite upsetting.
So,
and this is only happening in the United States, by the way. We don't have this financial toxicity issue in any of the other, you know, OECD countries. So it's a uniquely American phenomena.
And you're the one of the founders of New York Healthcare for All.
Yes.
That goes to the issue of Medicare for All, of universal health care. That's the phenomenon that is what we experience. They're not experiencing in those countries because they have basic health care.
Yes.
So talk about what that would mean. And the other issue you raised is the issue of medical debt, something else we just have here in this country.
Right. Because we have this whole free market system for health care, which is, you know, it's a free market health system. So you have the carriers who have their financial interests, insurance plans, and then you have the providers and hospitals who have all their financial interests. Those entities are, and the pharmacy, big pharma has its own financial interests. All of those entities are in sort of this nuclear arms race. Everybody has an incentive to charge more, right? Health plan makes more money because they just charge all of us more in premiums. So they have, we all thought that the health plans would negotiate better hospital prices with the hospitals. But we see in a place like New York, the health plans are required basically to have all the hospitals, all the fancy hospitals in their networks. So there's no price controls happening. There's no real economics 101, the microeconomics we all might have learned in college or graduate school or whatever. It doesn't work in healthcare because it's an urgent, visceral, you have to have it. No one has bargaining power in this system. And so all the big financial interests just have an interest in making more money. So I think what happens in other countries is, for example, even in Switzerland, which has private health insurance, the government sets the reimbursement rates for the providers, for the drugs. And so the insurance companies are administering, private insurance is administering, but they're not administering the reimbursement rates. New York State used to set hospital reimbursement rates, and we got rid of that in favor of a free market system, which, and what's happened, our healthcare prices have gone up, and now we have the second most expensive healthcare in the country.
And you're one of the leaders on tackling medical debt. What is happening in the country around that, state by state?
Well, what's amazing is the people are really fighting back. So here in New York State, we did an inventory of all the hospital lawsuits against patients, showed that about 13,000 patients were being sued by hospitals every year. We then went on this campaign.
So the sickest patients are being sued by hospitals saying, you've got to give us money.
Right.
Even though often they have a large charity disbursement that the patients didn't know about.
Right.
That if there's a person who can't afford, they get the money from the
state. Especially in a place like New York, where every one of our hospitals is a nonprofit charity. So I work for a charity. We never sue our patients. I mean, our clients. So I'm not sure why hospitals think that a nonprofit charitable entity thinks it's okay to sue their patients. Whole other story. But we just, from the people fighting, which is what is really starting to happen throughout the country, like what we did in New York's really spreading like wildfire, even in places like North Carolina that aren't known for their progressive policies necessarily, we started fighting back. We changed the statute of limitations. Hospitals now only have, and medical providers only have 3 years instead of 6 years to sue people. They used to be able to charge 9% interest. Now it's 2%. We no longer allow them to be able to report medical debt to the credit reporting agencies, so the debt collectors can't, like, hound you and terrify you into it, especially since we know from medical, if you have medical debt, you're more likely to be a better credit risk than a bad one. So why would it ever be on your credit report? It just crazy. No longer can they take, get this, they used to take liens on people's homes, primary residences. They used to be able to take garnish wages of working people. Gone. No longer allowed to do that. And then finally, we made a total ban on suing anybody below 400% of the federal poverty level, which really saves.
How many states have this, though? This is New York.
This is New York. But we're seeing other states do that. Maryland has something very similar. The unions, in partnership with the people, have done a great job in their campaign in Maryland. We see some movement in Maine, Massachusetts, Illinois. Colorado's done a lot of work around this area, too.
So what would Medicare for All look like? How would that change the landscape for people, the health of the nation?
Well, first of all, right now we spend more, around 16% of our GDP, on health care. If we had a Medicare for all system, that would probably, even in the most expensive other industrialized country, it's around 10-12%. So we would save billions, trillions probably, if we had Medicare for all. And so all of that could go into paychecks and making people's lives better, right? So we would have the money instead of giving it to these big industries. The second thing that would happen is that we wouldn't have people with a thing called deductibles and co-insurance. So in a way to deter utilization, the industry tries to vilify patients, like we're just desperate to overconsume healthcare. That's actually not true. We have the lowest average length of stays in hospitals compared to any OECD country. So it's not about patient utilization. It's truly about the prices. And there was a famous Princeton economist, Uwe Reinhardt, who died. He said, it's the prices, stupid. And it really, and that was a famous article, but it's still true these 20 years later. So it's very sad. If we had Medicare for all, we wouldn't be paying as much, and we would probably have much better health outcomes, because people, it wouldn't be irrational if Kevin gets his treatment or not. People would, you know, we'd have a higher life expectancy, we'd have better health outcomes, we could monitor quality, enforce quality around the system. It would just be so much easier for patients. Patients wouldn't have medical debt. You know, providers wouldn't be spending time with the insurance company on paperwork. They could be actually providing health care to us.
And the discussion is going in the other direction with the new administration, not just not Medicare for all, but privatizing Medicare and Social Security.
Right, which means that there's more cost sharing for patients, right? Deductibles, co-insurance, higher co-pays. And it'd be one thing if we had all of those things were structured in a way to incentivize people getting care. So, for example, what that means is if someone has diabetes and needs insulin, we all want them to have insulin. If they don't take their insulin, they shouldn't be rationing their insulin. If they don't take their insulin, they're going to lose a foot. That's super expensive for all of us, right? But instead, we put copays and deductibles on insulin. So what's amazing is really smart states like New York last year under Governor Hochul and the Superintendent of Financial Services said, we're going to have zero copays for insulin. Like, why? Why would you ever charge people for insulin, period? That should just, the insurance company should want to have that person using their insulin. We should be doing that for a range of medications to really be improving healthcare for people instead of for profit.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you both for being with us. Elizabeth Benjamin is vice president at the Community Service Society of New York and co-founder of Healthcare for All New York campaign. And I want to thank Kevin Dwyer, who has cystic fibrosis, was denied life-saving medicine by United Healthcare for 9 months until the Community Service Society, the Today Show, lawyers all got involved so that he could have the same health care that his sister had from the same insurance company. Astounding story. Coming up, Don't Obey in Advance, Yale historian Timothy Snyder on everything from Trump's billionaire cabinet to ABC News' multi-million-dollar settlement with Trump. Stay with us.
Sharks anymore. The message read as it washed ashore. Skies turn black as my eyes look down. Written on the back of these words I found. We'll inherit the earth, but we don't want it.
We'll Inherit the Earth by The Replacements. Guitarist Slim Dunlap passed away Wednesday at the age of 73. And as we come to the end of the year, we've been playing a lot of the music of musicians who've passed in this past year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with Yale historian and author Timothy Snyder, author of numerous books, including On Freedom and before that On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Professor Snyder published On Tyranny in February of 2017, just a month after Donald Trump took office. The first lesson in the book is do not obey in advance. Snyder wrote, quote, most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want, and then they offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts in this way is teaching power what it can do. Snyder's warning was widely cited after ABC News settled a defamation suit filed by President-elect Trump instead of taking the case to court. As part of the deal, ABC will donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library. Meanwhile, three prominent tech billionaires, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, and Sam Altman of OpenAI, have reportedly agreed for their companies to donate $1 million each to Trump's inaugural fund. Zuckerberg, who once banned Trump from Facebook, recently dined with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. On Wednesday, Bezos, who also owns The Washington Post, dined with Trump and Elon Musk, the world's richest man, who's being described by some as the shadow president. I mean, in this looming government shutdown, it was Elon Musk who first tweeted on his social media platform X, threatening any Republican Congress member who voted for, at that time, the bill. And then Trump did his warnings. People then started referring to President Musk and Vice President Trump. Well, Timothy Snyder, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's start with the ABC settlement. George Stephanopoulos saying that President Trump had been found liable in a civil trial of rape because the judge in the case said that Trump had been found liable for sexual assault, which in common parlance, the judge said, was rape. Many felt ABC had a very strong leg to stand on. They were about to do discovery, and suddenly ABC settled. Your response?
Yeah, if I could, I first want to make a segue from your last segment, because there is a direct connection between healthcare and the ability of normal people not to obey in advance. One of the reasons why we have the absence of healthcare in this country that we do is to make people afraid and anxious and worried all of the time. And that is a kind of social wellspring for, you know, for authoritarianism. It's harder to do the things you need to do politically if you're being dogged all the time by unnecessary fears and costs, and when you're sick when you don't have to be. Anyway, as far as the big wealthy media companies are concerned, I think ABC saw the chance to do what everybody else was doing in a rapid way and sacrificed itself to make this statement that, yes, we're not going to say these kinds of things. Because the problem of giving up here isn't just the individual case, it's the precedent you set. You're saying we're going to be extremely careful not to say the kinds of things which might offend or which might be critical to this person who is now going to be the head of state.
And as soon as that settlement happened, President-elect Trump sued the Des Moines Register for a poll that came out right before the election that he didn't like the results of.
Yeah, I mean, they were moving squarely into totalitarian territory, because when Trump sues the Des Moines Register for essentially printing what he considers to have been bad news for him, the underlying all of that is the idea that Trump never could have been behind in any poll. Trump never could have won any election. Our great hero Trump is always going to win at everything. So it's setting a line, right, which borrows from his deep lie that he didn't win the election, that he won the election in 2020. So he's trying to set, I mean, what is it, in fact, a kind of Stalinist line for the American media. Everyone has to only print how Trump wins everything all the time, or you might get sued.
So if you can jump from that to what we're seeing now with the billionaire cabinet, you know, Elon Musk now it looks like spent about $250 million to get Trump elected. And people might say, wow, that's a lot. He took a great risk there. But he has made far more than that since the election of President Trump. If you can talk about what it means, I think in Biden's cabinet, there were something like $110 million. In this cabinet, well over what, $500 billion?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's a small jump to make because the way that censorship is going to work in the Musk-Trump regime is probably not going to be direct state censorship. It's going to be hundreds of frivolous lawsuits, which are meant to keep us all quiet. And who's going to fund those frivolous lawsuits? Not Trump. He doesn't have the money. It's going to be Musk who's funding these frivolous lawsuits to keep us all quiet and to keep us towards the line that, of course, he and Trump never do anything wrong, always win, and so on. What we're looking at is a qualitative change. Of course, there's too much money in every cabinet, but we're now leaping orders of magnitude up, right? So, for example, when if a centibillionaire gives $1 million to Trump's inauguration, that might sound like a lot, but that's the same as the median American family giving $2. It's meaningless for the centibillionaire to give that amount of money. Likewise, it was meaningless even for Musk to spend $250 million on Trump's campaign. The guy is worth something like $400 billion now. That meant nothing to him, and the return to investment was absolutely enormous. So we're shifting from a democracy which had some pretty heavy oligarchical streaks running through it towards something like an oligarchy, in which I think it's fair to say that it's not Trump who's the most important person. It's Musk. Trump has debts. Musk has money. Trump has debts specifically to Musk for getting him elected. And I think the burden of proof is actually on Trump to show that he has any room for maneuver in this system. And it's going to be interesting to see how congressional Republicans react, because what this particular oligarch wants is to break the federal government. And whatever their views might be, many of them don't actually want the United States of America to cease to exist so that oligarchs can pick up the pieces.
Let me ask you about MSNBC. You had the regular Trump critics, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, for a few years now, really criticizing Trump. And then after he won, going down to Mar-a-Lago to have dinner with him.
Yeah. I mean, I think the essential thing is not whether you criticize Trump or whether you don't criticize him. I don't think it's all about Trump. I think the essential thing is, are you seeking after truth? Are you doing investigative stories? Are you saying the things you're truly convinced of based on the results of your investigations and the facts? I think it doesn't make sense to court somebody like Trump, just psychologically, because he's into humiliation both directions. He wants to humiliate you, and then he wants himself to be humiliated by the guys he regards as bigger men, people like Musk and by Putin. For him, it's all a humiliation chain, and you're just telling him which side of the humiliation chain you want to be on. So I think politically, it's not really very effective. But I think the most important thing for the press is to do the job of the press and not to think of everything in terms of paying obeisance or not paying obeisance. And the press needs to be itself.
The significance, I mean, you have Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, who owns The Washington Post. He stops the endorsement of Kamala Harris of his editorial board. Same thing at The Los Angeles Times with Patrick Soon-Shiong, doing the same there, intervening and now being quite involved with the editorial process. You have the $1 million donations to the inaugural committee of President Trump, the inauguration, with $1 million contributions each coming from Zuckerberg, from Bezos, and more.
I mean, again, with those $1 million contributions, it's kind of funny because since Trump is a fake rich person, he thinks that's a lot of money, right? But for them, it's literally
I think it's
not
a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. For us, it's a lot of money, right? So for American, this is the problem with oligarchy. It's the problem with huge wealth inequality. The math is staggering. We can't really grasp it, right? $1 million would be absolutely life-changing for 99.9% of Americans. But for these people, it's literally the equivalent for the median American family of $2. It means nothing to them. It's just symbolic. It's just symbolic obeisance to Trump. But I want to jump back to the LA Times and the Washington Post. There is a problem when the people who have the most money set the example of yielding to power first. It's a problem. They shouldn't do it. It is obeying advance. It's textbook anticipatory obedience. It's absolutely 180 degrees, not what they should have done. That said, in the regime that's coming, not obeying in advance means that little people, little organizations, little groups, municipalities, judges, NGOs, we have to all not obey in advance. We can't take our lead from these people. it's not obeying the advance is always going to be tense because other people going to obey the advance, including powerful people. So we have to not behave the way the powerful are behaving.
Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University, author of numerous books, including On Freedom and On Tyranny. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.